Chapter 12. Screen Language.
Tell me again,
said Dr. Oliver Payne, in the little laboratory overlooking the park.
Either I didn't hear you, or you're talking nonsense. A child from another world?
That's what she said. All right, it's nonsense, but listen to it, Oliver, will you? She knew about shadows. She calls them... it. She calls it dust. But it's the same thing. It's our shadow particles. And I'm telling you, when she was wearing the electrodes linking her to the cave, there was the most extraordinary display on the screen. Pictures, symbols. She had an instrument, too. A sort of compass thing made of gold, with different symbols all around the rim. And she said she could read that in the same way. And she knew about the state of mind, too. She knew it intimately.
It was mid-morning. Lyra's scholar, Dr. Malone, was red-eyed from lack of sleep, and her colleague, who'd just returned from Geneva, was impatient to hear more, and sceptical, and preoccupied.
And the point was, Oliver, she was communicating with them. They are conscious, and they can respond. And you remember your skulls? Well, she told me about some skulls in the Pitt Rivers Museum. She'd found out with her compass thing that they were much older than the museum said. And there were shadows.
Wait a minute. Give me some sort of structure here. What are you saying? You saying she's confirmed what we know already, or that she's telling us something new?
Both. I don't know. But suppose something happened 30,000, 40,000 years ago. There were shadow particles around before then, obviously. I mean, they've been around since the Big Bang, but there was no physical way of amplifying their effects at our level, the anthropic level, the level of human beings. And then something happened. I can't imagine what, but it involved evolution. Hence, your skulls, remember? No shadows before that time, lots afterwards. And the skulls the child found in the museum, that she tested with her compass thing. She told me the same thing. What I'm saying is that around that time, the human brain became the ideal vehicle for this amplification process. Suddenly, we became conscious.
Dr. Payne tilted his plastic mug and drank the last of his coffee.
Why should it happen particularly at that time? Why suddenly 35,000 years ago?
Who can say? We're not paleontologists. I don't know, Oliver. I'm just speculating. Don't you think it's at least possible?
And this policeman, tell me about him.
Dr. Malone rubbed her eyes.
Oh, his name is Walters. He said he was from the special branch. I thought that was politics or something.
Terrorism, subversion, intelligence, all that. Go on. What did he want? Why did he come here?
Because of the girl. He said he was looking for a boy of about the same age. He didn't tell me why. And this boy had been seen in the company of the girl who came here. But he had something else in mind as well, Oliver. He knew about the research. He even asked...
The telephone rang. She broke off, shrugging, and Dr. Payne answered it. He spoke briefly, put it down, and said...
We've got a visitor.
Who?
Not a name I know. Sir somebody, something... Listen, Mary... I'm off. You realize that, don't you?
They offered you the job?
Yes. I've got to take it. You must see that.
Well, that's the end of this, then.
He spread his hands helplessly and said...
To be frank, I can't see any point in the sort of stuff you've just been talking about. Children from another world and fossil shadows. It's all too crazy. I just can't get involved. I've got a career, Mary.
What about the skulls you tested? What about the shadows around the ivory figurine?
He shook his head and turned his back. Before he could answer, there came a tap at the door, and he opened it almost with relief. Sir Charles said,
Good day to you. Dr. Payne? Dr. Malone? My name's Charles Latram. It's very good of you to see me without any notice.
Come in,
said Dr. Malone, weary but puzzled.
Did Oliver say, Sir Charles? What can we do for you?
It may be what I can do for you. I understand you're waiting for the results of your funding application.
How do you know that?
I used to be a civil servant. As a matter of fact, I was concerned with directing scientific policy. I still have a number of contacts in the field, and I heard... May I sit down?
Oh, please.
She pulled out a chair, and he sat down as if he were in charge of a meeting.
Thank you. I heard through a friend. I'd better not mention his name. The Official Secrets Act covers all sorts of silly things. I heard that your application was being considered, and what I heard about it intrigued me so much that I must confess I asked to see some of your work. Well, I know I had no business to, except that I still act as a sort of unofficial adviser, so I used that as an excuse. And really, what I saw was quite fascinating.
Does that mean you think we'll be successful?
Said Dr. Malone, leaning forward, eager to believe him.
Unfortunately, no. I must be blunt. They're not minded to renew your grant.
Dr. Malone's shoulders slumped. Dr. Payne was watching the old man with cautious curiosity.
Why have you come here now, then?
Well, you see, they haven't officially made the decision yet. It doesn't look promising, and I'm being frank with you. They see no prospect of funding work of this sort in the future. However, it might be that if you had someone to argue the case for you, they would see it differently.
An advocate? You mean yourself? I didn't think it worked like that,
said Dr. Malone, sitting up.
I thought they went on peer review and so on.
It does in principle, of course, but it also helps to know how these committees work in practice, and to know who is on them. Well, here I am. I'm intensely interested in your work. I think it might be very valuable, and it certainly ought to continue. Would you let me make informal representations on your behalf?
Dr. Malone felt like a drowning sailor being thrown a lifebelt.
Why, well, yes. Good grief, of course. And thank you. I mean, do you really think it'll make a difference? I don't mean to suggest that... I don't know what I mean. Yes, of course.
What would we have to do?
Dr. Malone looked at him in surprise. Hadn't Oliver just said he was going to work in Geneva? But he seemed to be understanding Sir Charles better than she was, for a flicker of complicity was passing between them, and Oliver came to sit down too.
I'm glad you take my point. You're quite right. There is a direction I'd be especially glad to see you taking. And, provided we could agree, I might even be able to find you some extra money from another source altogether.
Wait. Wait a minute. The course of this research is a matter for us. I'm perfectly willing to discuss the results, but not the direction. Well, surely you see.
Sir Charles spread his hands in a gesture of regret and got to his feet. Oliver Payne stood too, anxious.
No, please, Sir Charles. I'm sure Dr. Malone will hear you out. Mary, there's no harm in listening, for goodness sake, and it might make all the difference.
I thought you were going to Geneva.
Geneva? Excellent place. Lot of scope there. Lot of money, too. Don't let me hold you back.
No, it's not settled yet. There's a lot to discuss. It's all still very fluid. Sir Charles, please, sit down. Can I get you some coffee?
That would be very kind,
said Sir Charles, and sat again with the air of a satisfied cat. Dr. Malone looked at him clearly for the first time. She saw a man in his late 60s, prosperous, confident, beautifully dressed, used to the very best of everything, used to moving among powerful people and whispering in important ears. Oliver was right. He did want something. And they wouldn't get his support unless they satisfied him. She folded her arms. Dr. Payne handed him a mug, saying,
Sorry, it's rather primitive.
Not at all. Shall I go on with what I was saying?
Do, please.
Well, I understand that you've made some fascinating discoveries in the field of consciousness. Yes, I know you haven't published anything yet, and it's a long way, seemingly, from the apparent subject of your research. Nevertheless, word gets around, and I'm especially interested in that. I would be very pleased if, for example, you were to concentrate your research on the manipulation of consciousness. Second, the many worlds hypothesis. Everett, you remember? 1957 or thereabouts? I believe you're on the track of something that could take that theory a good deal further. And that line of research might even attract defense funding, which, as you may know, is still plentiful even today, and certainly isn't subject to these wearisome application processes. Don't expect me to reveal my sources,
he went on, holding up his hand as Dr. Malone sat forward and tried to speak.
I mentioned the Official Secrets Act. A tedious piece of legislation, but we mustn't be naughty about it. I confidently expect some advances in the many worlds area. I think you are the people to do it. And third, there is a particular matter connected with an individual, a child.
He paused there and sipped the coffee. Dr. Malone couldn't speak. She'd gone pale, though she couldn't know that, but she did know that she felt faint.
For various reasons, I am in contact with the intelligence services. They are interested in a child, a girl, who has an unusual piece of equipment. An antique scientific instrument, certainly stolen, which should be in safer hands than hers. There's also a boy of roughly the same age, 12 or so, who is wanted in connection with a murder. It's a moot point whether a child of that age is capable of murder, of course, but he has certainly killed someone. And he has been seen with the girl. Now, Dr. Malone, it may be that you have come across one or the other of these children, and it may be that you're quite properly inclined to tell the police about what you know, but you would be doing a greater service if you were to let me know privately. I can make sure the proper authorities deal with it efficiently and quickly, and with no stupid tabloid publicity. I know that Inspector Walters came to see you yesterday, and I know that the girl turned up. You see, I do know what I'm talking about. I would know, for instance, if you saw her again. And if you didn't tell me, I would know that, too. You'd be very wise to think hard about that, and to clarify your recollections of what she said and did when she was here. This is a matter of national security, you understand me? Well, there, I'll stop. Here's my card, so you can get in touch. I shouldn't leave it too long. The funding committee meets tomorrow, as you know. But you can reach me at this number at any time.
He gave a card to Oliver Payne, and seeing Dr. Malone with her arms still folded, laid one on the bench for her. Dr. Payne held the door for him. Sir Charles set his Panama hat on his head, patted it gently, beamed at both of them, and left. When he'd shut the door again, Dr. Payne said,
"Mary, are you mad? Where's the sense in behaving like that?"
"I beg your pardon. You're not taken in by that old creep, are you?"
"You can't turn down offers like that. Do you want this project to survive or not?"
"It wasn't an offer. It was an ultimatum. Do as he says, or close down. And, Oliver, for God's sake, all those not-so-subtle threats and hints about national security and so on, can't you see where that would lead?"
"Well, I think I can see it more clearly than you can. If you said no, they wouldn't close this place down. They'd take it over. If they're as interested as he says, they'll want it to carry on, but only on their terms."
"But their terms would be, I mean, defense, for God's sake! They want to find new ways of killing people. And you heard what he said about consciousness. He wants to manipulate it. I'm not going to get mixed up in that, Oliver. Never!"
"They'll do it anyway, and you'll be out of a job. If you stay, you might be able to influence it in a better direction. And you'd still have your hands on the work. You'd still be involved."
"But what does it matter to you anyway? I thought Geneva was all settled."
He ran his hands through his hair and said,
"Well, not settled, nothing signed, and it would be a different angle altogether, and I'd be sorry to leave here now that I think we're really on to something."
"What are you saying?"
"I'm not saying..."
"You're hinting. What are you getting at?"
"Well..."
He walked around the laboratory, spreading his hands, shrugging, shaking his head.
"Well, if you don't get in touch with them, I will."
"Oh, I see."
"Mary, I've got to think
of
my..."
"Of course you have."
"It's not that
no,
I want..."
"No,
no." "You don't understand..."
"Yes, how... I do. It's very simple. You promise to do as he says. You get the funding. I leave. You take over as director. It's not hard to understand. You'd have a bigger budget, lots of nice new machines, half a dozen more PhDs under you. Good idea. You do it, Oliver. You go ahead. But that's it for me. I'm off. It stinks."
"You haven't..."
But her expression silenced him. She took off her white coat and hung it on the door, gathered a few papers into a bag, and left without a word. As soon as she'd gone, he took Sir Charles's card and picked up the phone. Several hours later, just before midnight, in fact, Dr. Malone parked her car outside the science building and let herself in at the side entrance. But just as she turned to climb the stairs, a man came out of another corridor, startling her so much she nearly dropped her briefcase. He was wearing a uniform.
"Where are you going?"
He stood in the way, bulky, his eyes hardly visible under the low brim of his cap.
"I'm going to my laboratory. I work here. Who are you?"
she said, a little angry, a little frightened.
"Security. Have you got some ID?"
"What security? I left this building at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and there was only a porter on duty, as usual. I should be asking you for identification. Who appointed you, and why?"
"Here's my ID,"
said the man, showing her a card too quickly for her to read it.
"Where's yours?"
She noticed he had a mobile phone in a holster at his hip. Or was it a gun? No, surely she was being paranoid. And he hadn't answered her questions. But if she persisted, she'd make him suspicious, and the important thing now was to get into the lab. Soothe him like a dog, she thought. She fumbled through her bag and found her wallet.
"Will this do?"
she said, showing him the card she used to operate the barrier in the car park. He looked at it briefly.
"What are you doing here at this time of night?"
"I've got an experiment running. I have to check the computer periodically."
He seemed to be searching for a reason to forbid her, or perhaps he was just exercising his power. Finally he nodded and stood aside. She went past, smiling at him, but his face remained blank. When she reached the laboratory, she was still trembling. There had never been any more security in this building than a lock on the door and an elderly porter, and she knew why the change had come about. But it meant that she had very little time. She'd have to get it right at once, because once they realized what she was doing, she wouldn't be able to come back again. She locked the door behind her and lowered the blinds. She switched on the detector and then took a floppy disk from her pocket and slipped it into the computer that controlled the cave. Within a minute she had begun to manipulate the numbers on the screen, going half by logic, half by guesswork, and half by the program she'd worked on all evening at home, and the complexity of her task was about as baffling as getting three halves to make one whole. Finally she brushed the hair out of her eyes and put the electrodes on her head, and then flexed her fingers and began to type. She felt intensely self-conscious.
"Hello. I'm not sure what I'm doing. Maybe this is crazy."
The words arranged themselves on the left of the screen, which was the first surprise. She wasn't using a word processing program of any kind. In fact, she was bypassing much of the operating system. And whatever formatting was imposing itself on the words, it wasn't hers. She felt the hairs begin to stir on the back of her neck, and she became aware of the whole building around her. The corridors dark, the machines idling, various experiments running automatically, computers monitoring tests and recording the results, the air conditioning sampling and adjusting the humidity and the temperature, all the ducts and pipework and cabling that were the arteries and the nerves of the building, awake and alert, almost conscious in fact. She tried again.
"I'm trying to do with words what I've done before with a state of mind, but..."
Before she had even finished the sentence, the cursor raced across to the right of the screen and printed,
"Ask a question."
It was almost instantaneous. She felt as if she'd stepped on a space that wasn't there. Her whole being lurched with shock. It took several moments for her to calm down enough to try again. When she did, the answers lashed themselves across the right of the screen almost before she'd finished.
"Are you shadows?"
"Yes."
"Are you the same as Lyra's dust?"
"Yes."
"And is that dark matter?"
"Yes."
"Dark matter is conscious?"
"Evidently."
"What I said to Oliver this morning, my idea about human evolution... is it..."
"Correct, but you need to ask more questions."
She stopped, took a deep breath, pushed her chair back, flexed her fingers. She could feel her heart racing. Every single thing about what was happening was impossible. All her education, all her habits of mind, all her sense of herself as a scientist were shrieking at her silently. "This is wrong. It isn't happening. You're dreaming." And yet there they were on the screen, her questions and answers from some other mind. She gathered herself and typed again, and again the answers zipped into being with no discernible pause.
"The mind that is answering these questions isn't human, is it?"
"No, but humans have always known us."
"Us? There's more than one of you."
"Uncountable billions."
"But what are you?"
"Angels."
Mary Malone's head rang. She'd been brought up as a Catholic. More than that, as Lyra had discovered, she had once been a nun. None of her faith was left to her now, but she knew about angels. St. Augustine had said, "Angel is the name of their office, not of their nature. If you seek the name of their nature, it is spirit. If you seek the name of their office, it is angel. From what they are, spirit. From what they do, angel." Dizzy, trembling, she typed again.
"Angels are creatures of shadow matter, of dust."
"Structures, complexifications, yes."
"And shadow matter is what we have called spirit?"
"From what we are, spirit. From what we do, matter. Matter and spirit are one."
She shivered. They'd been listening to her thoughts.
"And did you intervene in human evolution?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Vengeance."
"Vengeance for... rebel angels! After the war in heaven, Satan and the Garden of Eden... but it isn't true, is it? Is that what you..."
"Find the girl and the boy. Waste no more time."
"But why?"
"You must play the serpent."
She took her hands from the keyboard and rubbed her eyes. The words were still there when she looked again.
"Where?"
Go to a road called Sunderland Avenue and find a tent. Deceive the guardian and go through. Take provisions for a long journey. You will be protected. The spectres will not touch you.
But I...
Before you go, destroy this equipment.
I don't understand. Why me? And what's this journey? And...
You have been preparing for this as long as you have lived. Your work here is finished. The last thing you must do in this world is prevent the enemies from taking control of it. Destroy the equipment. Do it now and go at once.
Mary Malone pushed back the chair and stood up, trembling. She pressed her fingers to her temples and discovered the electrodes still attached to her skin. She took them off absently. She might have doubted what she had done and what she could still see on the screen, but she had passed in the last half hour or so beyond doubt and belief altogether. Something had happened, and she was galvanized. She switched off the detector and the amplifier. Then she bypassed all the safety codes and formatted the computer's hard disk, wiping it clean. And then she removed the interface between the detector and the amplifier, which was on a specially adapted card, and put the card on the bench and smashed it with the heel of her shoe, there being nothing else heavy at hand. Next, she disconnected the wiring between the electromagnetic shield and the detector, and found the wiring plan in a drawer of the filing cabinet and set light to it. Was there anything else she could do? She couldn't do much about Oliver Payne's knowledge of the program, but the special hardware was effectively demolished. She crammed some papers from a drawer into her briefcase, and finally took down the poster with the I Ching hexagrams and folded it away in her pocket. Then she switched off the light and left. The security guard was standing at the foot of the stairs, speaking into his telephone. He put it away as she came down, and escorted her silently to the side entrance, watching through the glass door as she drove away. An hour and a half later, she parked her car in a road near Sunderland Avenue. She had had to find it on a map of Oxford. She didn't know this part of town. Up till this moment, she had been moving on pent-up excitement, but as she got out of her car in the dark of the small hours and found the night cool and silent and still all around her, she felt a definite lurch of apprehension. Suppose she was dreaming? Suppose it was all some elaborate joke? Well, it was too late to worry about that. She was committed. She lifted up the rucksack she'd often taken on camping journeys in Scotland and the Alps, and reflected that at least she knew how to survive out of doors. If worst came to worst, she could always run away, take to the hills. Ridiculous. But she swung the rucksack onto her back, left the car, turned into the Banbury Road, and walked the 200 or 300 yards up to where Sunderland Avenue ran left from the traffic circle. She felt almost more foolish than she had ever felt in her life. But as she turned the corner and saw those strange, childlike trees that Will had seen, she knew that something at least was true about all this. Under the trees on the grass at the far side of the road, there was a small square tent of red and white nylon, the sort that electricians put up to keep the rain off while they work, and parked close by was an unmarked white transit van with darkened glass at the windows. Better not hesitate. She walked straight across towards the tent. When she was nearly there, the back door of the van swung open and a policeman stepped out. Without his helmet, he looked very young, and the streetlight under the dense green of the leaves above shone full on his face.
Could I ask where you're going, madam?
Into that tent.
I'm afraid you can't, madam. I've got orders not to let anyone near it.
Good. I'm glad they've got the place protected. But I'm from the Department of Physical Sciences. Sir Charles Latram asked us to make a preliminary survey and then report back before they look at it properly. It's important that it's done now, while there aren't many people around. I'm sure you understand the reasons for that.
Well, yes, but have you got anything to show who you are?
Oh, sure,
she said, and swung the rucksack off her back to get at her purse. Among the items she'd taken from the drawer in the laboratory was an expired library card of Oliver Payne's. 15 minutes' work at her kitchen table, and the photograph from her own passport, had produced something she hoped would pass for genuine. The policeman took the laminated card and looked at it closely.
Dr. Olive Payne. Do you happen to know a Dr. Mary Malone?
Oh, yes. She's a colleague.
Do you know where she is now?
At home in bed, if she's got any sense. Why?
Well, I understand her position in your organization's been terminated, and she wouldn't be allowed through here. In fact, we've got orders to detain her if she tries. And seeing a woman, I naturally thought you might be her, if you see what I mean. Excuse me, Dr. Payne.
Ah, I see,
said Mary Malone. The policeman looked at the card once more.
Still, this seems all right,
he said, and handed it back. Nervous, wanting to talk, he went on.
Do you know what's in there under that tent?
Well, not first hand. That's why I'm here now.
Oh, I suppose it is. All right then, Dr. Payne.
He stood back and let her unlace the flap of the tent. She hoped he wouldn't see the shaking of her hands. Clutching the rucksack to her breast, she stepped through. Deceive the guardian. Well, she'd done that. But she had no idea what she would find inside the tent. She was prepared for some sort of archaeological dig, for a dead body, for a meteorite. But nothing in her life or her dreams had prepared her for that square yard or so in midair, or for the silent, sleeping city by the sea that she found when she stepped through it. Chapter 13. Asa Heather. As the moon rose, the witches began their spell to heal Will's wound. They woke him and asked him to lay the knife on the ground where it caught a glitter of starlight. Lyra sat nearby, stirring some herbs in a pot of boiling water over a fire, and while her companions clapped and stamped and cried in rhythm, Seraphina crouched over the knife and sang in a high, fierce tone.
Little knife, they tore your iron out of Mother Earth's entrails, built a fire and boiled the ore, made it weep and bleed and flood, hammered it and tempered it, plunging it in icy water, heating it inside the forge, till your blade was blood-red, scorching. Then they made you wound the water once again and yet again, till the steam was boiling fog. And the water cried for mercy. And when you sliced a single shade into 30,000 shadows, then they knew that you were ready. Then they called you Subtle One. But Little Knife, what have you done? Unlocked blood gates left them wide. Little Knife, your mother calls you from the entrails of the earth, from her deepest mines and caverns, from her secret iron womb. Listen.
And Seraphina stamped again and clapped her hands with the other witches, and they shook their throats to make a wild ululation that tore at the air like claws. Will, seated in the middle of them, felt a chill at the core of his spine. Then Seraphina Pekala turned to Will himself and took his wounded hand in both of hers. When she sang this time, he nearly flinched, so fierce was her high, clear voice, so glittering her eyes. But he sat without moving and let the spell go on.
Blood, obey me. Turn around. Be a lake and not a river. When you reach the open air, stop and build a clotted wall. Build it firm to hold the flood back. Blood, your sky is the skull dome. Your sun is the open eye. Your wind, the breath inside the lungs. Blood, your world is bounded. Stay there.
Will thought he could feel all the atoms of his body responding to her command, and he joined in, urging his leaking blood to listen and obey. She put his hand down and turned to the little iron pot over the fire. A bitter steam was rising from it, and Will heard the liquid bubbling fiercely. Seraphina sang,
Oak bark, spider silk, ground moss, saltweed, grip close, bind tight. Hold fast, close up, bar the door, lock the gate, stiffen the blood wall, dry the gore flood.
Then the witch took her own knife and split an alder sapling along its whole length. The wounded whiteness gleamed open in the moon. She daubed some of the steaming liquid into the split, then closed up the wood, easing it together from the root to the tip. And the sapling was whole again. Will heard Lyra gasp, and turned to see another witch holding a squirming, struggling hare in her tough hands. The animal was panting, wild-eyed, kicking furiously, but the witch's hands were merciless. In one she held its forelegs, and with the other she grasped its hind legs and pulled the frenzied hare out straight, its heaving belly upward. Seraphina's knife swept across it. Will felt himself grow dizzy, and Lyra was restraining Pantalaimon. Hare formed himself in sympathy, who was bucking and snapping in her arms. The real hare fell still, eyes bulging, breast heaving, entrails glistening. But Seraphina took some more of the decoction and trickled it into the gaping wound, and then closed up the wound with her fingers, smoothing the wet fur over it until there was no wound at all. The witch holding the animal relaxed her grip and let it gently to the ground, where it shook itself, turned to lick its flank, flicked its ears, and nibbled a blade of grass as if it were completely alone. Suddenly it seemed to become aware of the circle of witches around it, and like an arrow it shot away, whole again, bounding swiftly off into the dark. Lyra, soothing Pantalaimon, glanced at Will and saw that he knew what it meant. The medicine was ready. He held out his hand, and as Seraphina daubed the steaming mixture on the bleeding stumps of his fingers, he looked away and breathed in sharply several times, but he didn't flinch. Once his open flesh was thoroughly soaked, the witch pressed some of the sodden herbs onto the wounds and tied them tight around with a strip of silk. And that was it. The spell was done. Will slept deeply through the rest of the night. It was cold, but the witches piled leaves over him, and Lyra slept huddled close behind his back. In the morning, Seraphina dressed his wound again, and he tried to see from her expression whether it was healing, but her face was calm and impassive. Once they'd eaten, Seraphina told the children that the witches had agreed that since they'd come into this world to find Lyra and be her guardians, they'd help Lyra do what she now knew her task to be, namely to guide Will to his father. So they all set off, and it was quiet going for the most part. Lyra consulted the alethiometer to begin with, but warily, and learned that they should travel in the direction of the distant mountains they could see across the great bay. Never having been this high above the city, they weren't aware of how the coastline curved, and the mountains had been below the horizon. But now when the trees thinned, or when a slope fell away below them, they could look out to the empty blue sea and to the high blue mountains beyond, which were their destination. It seemed a long way to go. They spoke little. Lyra was busy looking at all the life in the forest, from woodpeckers to squirrels to little green moss snakes with diamonds down their backs, and Will needed all his energy simply to keep going. Lyra and Pantalaimon discussed him endlessly.
"We could look at the alethiometer,"
Pantalaimon said at one point when they dawdled on the path to see how close they could get to a browsing fawn before it saw them.
"We never promised not to, and we could find out all kinds of things for him. We'd be doing it for him, not for us."
"Don't be stupid. It would be us we'd be doing it for, because he'd never ask. You're just greedy and nosy, Pan."
"That makes a change. It's normally you who's greedy and nosy, and me who has to warn you not to do things. Like in the retiring room at Jordan. I never wanted to go in there."
"If we hadn't, Pan, do you think all this would have happened?"
"No, because the master would have poisoned Lord Asriel, and that would have been the end of it."
"Yeah, I suppose. Who do you think Will's father is, though? And why is he important?"
"That's what I mean. We could find out in a moment."
And she looked wistful.
"I might have done once, but I'm changing, I think, Pan."
"No, you're not."
"You might not be. Hey, Pan, when I change, you'll stop changing. What are you going to be?"
"A flea, I hope."
"No, but don't you get any feelings about what you might be?"
"No, I don't want to either."
"You're sulking because I won't do what you want."
He changed into a pig and grunted and squealed and snorted till she laughed at him. And then he changed into a squirrel and darted through the branches beside her.
"Who do you think his father is? Do you think he could be anyone we met?"
"Could be, but he's bound to be someone important, almost as important as Lord Asriel. Bound to be. We know what we're doing is important after all."
"We don't know it. We think it is, but we don't know. We just decided to look for dust because Roger died."
"We know it's important,"
Lyra said hotly, and she even stamped her foot.
"And so do the witches. They come all this way to look for us just to be my guardians and help me. And we got to help Will find his father. That's important. You know it is too, else you wouldn't have licked him when he was wounded. Why'd you do that anyway? You never asked me if you could. I couldn't believe it when you did that."
"I did it because he didn't have a demon, and he needed one. And if you were half as good at seeing things as you think you are, you'd have known that."
"I did know it, really."
They stopped then because they'd caught up with Will, who was sitting on a rock beside the path. Pantalaimon became a flycatcher, and as he flew among the branches, Lyra said,
"Will, what do you think those kids will do now?"
"They won't be following us. They were too frightened of the witches. Maybe they'll just go back to drifting about."
"Yeah, probably. They might want to use the knife, though. They might come after us for that."
"Let them. They're not having it, not now. I didn't want it at first, but if it can kill the spectres..."
"I never trusted Angelica, not from the beginning."
"Yes, you did."
"Yeah, I did, really. I hated it in the end, that city."
"I thought it was heaven when I first found it. I couldn't imagine anything better than that. And all the time it was full of spectres and we never knew.
Well, I won't trust kids again. I thought back at Bolvanger that whatever grown-ups did, however bad it was, kids were different. They wouldn't do cruel things like that. But I ain't sure now. I've never seen kids like that before, and that's a fact.
I have.
When? In your world?
Yeah,
he said awkwardly. Lyra waited and sat still, and presently he went on.
It was when my mother was having one of her bad times. She and me, we lived on our own, see, because obviously my father wasn't there. And every so often she'd start thinking things that weren't true, and having to do things that didn't make sense, not to me anyway. I mean, she had to do them or else she'd get upset and afraid. And so I used to help her. Like touching all the railings in the park, or counting the leaves on the bush, that kind of thing. She used to get better after a while, but I was afraid of anyone finding out she was like that, because I thought they'd take her away, so I used to look after her and hide it. I never told anyone. And once, she got afraid when I wasn't there to help her. I was at school, and she went out, and she wasn't wearing very much, only she didn't know. And some boys from my school, they found her, and they started...
Will's face was hot. Without being able to help it, he found himself walking up and down and looking away from Lyra because his voice was unsteady and his eyes were watering. He went on.
They were tormenting her just like those kids at the tower with the cat. They thought she was mad, and they wanted to hurt her, maybe kill her. I wouldn't be surprised. She was just different, and they hated her. Anyway, I found her, and I got her home. And the next day in school, I fought the boy who was leading them. I fought him, and I broke his arm, and I think I broke some of his teeth. I don't know. And I was going to fight the rest of them too, but I got in trouble. And I realized I better stop, because they'd find out. I mean, the teachers and the authorities, they'd go to my mother and complain about me. And then they'd find out about how she was and take her away. So I just pretended to be sorry and told the teachers I wouldn't do it again. And they punished me for fighting, and I still said nothing. But I kept her safe, see. No one knew apart from those boys, and they knew what I'd do if they said anything. They knew I'd kill them another time. Not just hurt them. And a bit later she got better again. No one knew, ever. But after that, I never trusted children any more than grown-ups. They're just as keen to do bad things. So I wasn't surprised when those kids in Chigatse did that. But I was glad when the witches came.
He sat down again with his back to Lyra, and still not looking at her, he wiped his hand across his eyes. She pretended not to see.
Will, what you said about your mother, and Tullio, when the spectres got him, and when you said yesterday that you thought the spectres came from your world...
Yes. Because it doesn't make sense what was happening to her. She wasn't mad. Those kids might think she was mad and laugh at her and try to hurt her, but they were wrong. She wasn't mad. Except that she was afraid of things that I couldn't see. And she had to do things that looked crazy. You couldn't see the point of them, but obviously she could. Like her counting all the leaves. Or Tullio yesterday touching the stones in the wall. Maybe that was a way of trying to put the spectres off. If they turned their back on something frightening behind them and tried to get really interested in the stones and how they fit together or the leaves on the bush, like if only they could make themselves find that really important, they'd be safe. I don't know. It looks like that. There were real things for her to be frightened of, like those men who came and robbed us, but there was something else as well as them. So maybe we do have the spectres in my world. Only we can't see them, and we haven't got a name for them, but they're there, and they keep trying to attack my mother. So that's why I was glad yesterday when the alethiometer said she was all right.
He was breathing fast, and his right hand was gripping the handle of the knife in its sheath. Lyra said nothing, and Pantalaimon kept very still.
When did you know you had to look for your father?
She said after a while.
A long time ago. I used to pretend he was a prisoner, and I'd help him escape. I had long games by myself doing that. It used to go on for days. Or else, he was on this desert island, and I'd sail there and bring him home. And he'd know exactly what to do about everything. About my mother especially. And she'd get better, and he'd look after her, and me. And I could just go to school and have friends. and I'd have a mother and a father too. So I always said to myself that when I grew up, I'd go and look for my father. And my mother used to tell me that I was going to take up my father's mantle. She used to say that to make me feel good. I didn't know what it meant, but it sounded important.
Didn't you have friends?
How could I have friends? Friends. They come to your house, and they know your parents, and sometimes a boy might ask me round to his house, and I might go or I might not. But I could never ask him back, so I never had friends, really. I would have liked... I had my cat. I hope she's all right now. I hope someone's looking after her.
What about the man you killed?
Lyra said, her heart beating hard.
Who was he?
I don't know. If I killed him, I don't care. He deserved it. There were two of them. They kept coming to the house and pestering my mother till she was afraid again, and worse than ever. They wanted to know all about my father, and they wouldn't leave her alone. I'm not sure if they were police or what. I thought at first they were part of a gang or something, and they thought my father had robbed a bank maybe and hidden the money. But they didn't want money. They wanted papers. They wanted some letters that my father had sent. They broke into the house one day, and then I saw it would be safer if my mother was somewhere else. See, I couldn't go to the police and ask them for help, because they'd take my mother away. I didn't know what to do. So in the end, I asked this old lady who used to teach me the piano. She was the only person I could think of. I asked her if my mother could stay with her, and I took her there. I think she'll look after her all right. Anyway, I went back to the house to look for these letters, because I knew where she kept them, and I got them. And the men came to look and broke into the house again. It was night time or early morning, and I was hiding at the top of the stairs, and Moxie, my cat Moxie, she came out of the bedroom, and I didn't see her, nor did the man. And when I knocked into him, she tripped him up, and he fell right to the bottom of the stairs. And I ran away. That's all that happened, so I didn't mean to kill him, but I don't care if I did. I ran away and went to Oxford, and then I found that window. And that only happened because I saw the other cat and stopped to watch her. And she found the window first. If I hadn't seen her, or if Moxie hadn't come out of the bedroom, then...
Yeah, that was lucky. And me and Pam were thinking just now, what if I'd never gone into the wardrobe in the retiring room at Jordan and seen the master put poison in the wine? None of this would have happened either.
Both of them sat silent on the moss-covered rock in a slant of sunlight through the old pines and thought how many tiny chances had conspired to bring them to this place. Each of those chances might have gone a different way. Perhaps in another world, another Will had not seen the window in Sunderland Avenue and had wandered on, tired and lost, towards the Midlands until he was caught. And in another world, another Pantalaimon had persuaded another Lyra not to stay in the retiring room, and another Lord Asriel had been poisoned, and another Roger had survived to play with that Lyra forever, on the roofs and in the alleys of another unchanging Oxford. Presently Will was strong enough to go on, and they moved together along the path, with the great forest quiet around them.